At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Francis talked, but was Congress listening? Here's a hint, probably not, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the 24th of September. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We begin today in Washington, D.C. Sadly, not with the pontiff and his message of working together for the common good, the theme of the speech that he delivered to a joint meeting of Congress this morning. No, instead, we begin with reality as it exists in political America circa 2015. We are a week away from the latest potential shutdown of the federal government. I know you don't think it's real yet because the cable news channels haven't started their countdown clocks, but trust me on this one, we are running out of daylight. The fight this go-round is over spending caps and money for Planned Parenthood, which is why it's worth a mention that when the Senate finally did kick into gear today on a short-term fix, it was part of a completely unrelated bill called the Hire More Heroes Act of 2015. So, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams starts us off at the curious intersection of heroes, Planned Parenthood, and the way business really gets done in Washington today.
The Hire More Heroes Act started off kind of as a dig at Obamacare, exempting small businesses from certain parts of the law if they hired veterans. But now it's what's called a legislative vehicle.
This idea that Congress sometimes substitutes in the full text of one thing for the full text of something else is not uncommon.
Molly Reynolds is with the Brookings Institution.
You may recall that this same bill is also the vehicle that they were using to debate the disapproval resolution for the Iran deal.
But why not just write a new bill, especially if it's just a stopgap measure? Norman Orenstein is with the American Enterprise Institute.
You're on a ticking time clock here. With a week to go, you can't start from scratch. You've got to find some vehicle that was going to be moving along anyway.
He says we should think of Congress like a train station. You've got a train, or in this case, a bill, that's been prepped and ready to go. All the complex procedures to get it to a floor vote are done, so you dump the original purpose and maybe even content.
It's still ostensibly the same train. It's still got the same name and the same number, but it doesn't have the same passengers at all.
And that takes us back to House Joint Resolution 61, the Hire More Heroes Act, which a lot of vets didn't really like anyway. Peter Goodmanson is president of Recruit Military. He didn't know about the bill's new job, but
I'm not surprised.
He says he doesn't even bother following what Congress does, pretty much because of stuff like this.
So it's unfortunate that both sides can't review their high school civics and do it the way it should be done.
But it's unlikely that, in today's Congress, all of the members would be to do it the old-fashioned way. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
My fingerprints are on file with the federal government in like five, maybe six different ways. So it was with some alarm that I read the news the other day that the people who hacked government personnel files a couple of months ago got 5.5 million fingerprint records, not the original 1 million we were told. That is, of course, in addition to all the other data of mine that they made off with. Thing is that biometrics like fingerprints and retina scans and facial recognition were supposed to be the more secure future of identification technology. But while you can change a PIN or get a new checking account, fingerprints? Not really. Sally Herships has more on that.
When it comes to tech and security, passwords are passé.
A password is 10, 20 years old. I mean, we need something new.
Jeff Chaputra is chair of the Cybersecurity Department at the University of Maryland. But he says that new thing, biometrics, hasn't exactly gone mainstream, except on some iPhones. One reason, Shaputra says, is because updating all that infrastructure to scan your fingers or your eyes would be expensive. And if your information is hacked,
you cannot reset that. It's not easy to change your fingerprint.
Shaputra says that could have a negative impact on the biometric industry. But Mario Civitas, director of Carnegie Mellon's Biometric Center, says without a finger, mere pictures of fingerprints can't do much.
Not enough just to make the exact same fingerprint. Sensors are now getting smarter.
Now Civitas says it's all about using what are called liveliness tests, technology that can detect veins and reflexes.
Am I looking at a real finger? Am I looking at a real iris or a real face?
Cameron Camp is a security researcher with ESET, an IT security company. He agrees biometrics are safer than the old stuff, especially when they're combined with a password. But even that doesn't guarantee protection. Say a bad app gets onto your smartphone.
So if the app itself can hack the smartphone and get your biometrics off of there, it can make fake payments that are supposedly very trustworthy.
So, while technology continues to advance, developers still need to play that old game, staying one step ahead of the bad guys. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Speaking of old games, here's five words about Wall Street today. Started ugly, got less so. Here's another five. Details when we do the numbers. The Pope's visit has been designated a national special security event, which means road shutdowns and more police than you can count and all the other stuff you would expect. But the protective umbrella extends up, too. The Federal Aviation Administration wants to make sure the Pope isn't done wrong by any flying robots trying to get some aerial video for somebody's YouTube account. And it has instituted a no-drone zone for the duration of the papal visit. So, like all things odd and tech that we are curious about, we called up Ben Johnson. He is the host of Marketplace Tech to Make Me Smart. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so talk to me for a second about the Pope and the no-fly zone, the no-drone zone, as it were.
Okay, so first, Kai, let's think about the shape of this thing. Okay. It's almost like a giant Pope hat. So picture a giant Pope hat.
Okay, the mitre, it's called, technically, not a Pope hat.
Okay, sorry, the mitre.
Anyway.
It's a cylinder of space that sort of starts at the ground. In the case of the Pope's bubble in Philadelphia, or mitre in Philadelphia, it's 60 nautical miles across and about 18,000 feet high. So this is a no-joke, no-drone zone, Kai.
What happens to the unwary drone operator, though, if he accidentally or on purpose for that matter flies his drone into one of these things?
Yes. So I talked to this guy named John Ruprecht. Yeah. He's a drone enthusiast. He's a pilot. He's also an attorney. He writes a blog about drone law.
Got it all going on.
Yeah, he's kind of a wacky dude. I asked him about the penalties for flying into the no drone zone.
Okay.
If they actually think you have some type of imminent threat against the Pope under national security reasons, then they're actually authorized to use deadly force. So if they don't kill you, they can take your pilot's license away, fine you, throw you in jail for up to a year, and fine you up to possibly $100,000. But if you kill someone, $250,000. Wow. So don't do it.
Yeah, no, don't do it.
There are exceptions for law enforcement for the drone zone, Kai, of course. But you should remember here, drones can be kind of anything. This could be something as small as your hand, Kai,
sure.
And you do not want to fly even just like a toy into this area.
Talk to me about the bigger picture here, which is FAA rules on drones writ large. Where are we?
Yeah, so we're kind of in an interesting time, Kai. The FAA is still working on its plan to regulate drone use. The organization put out guidelines earlier this year. Those rules will likely become gospel, so to speak, in the next few years. Mm. As it stands right now, one of the key differences, Kai, between drone users is money. So if you're a hobbyist and you're flying a drone that's under 55 pounds and you're over 17 years old and you're flying during the day, you're fine. Things change once you start trying to make money.
Right. And so what happens if I am, I don't know, a realtor who wants to use it for a big, spiffy thing for a property I'm showing? Or, you know, I've done interviews with companies who are like controlling big earth moving equipment with the drones. What about that?
If you want to operate a drone at that scale, yeah. Kai, or maybe even a swarm of drones... You've got to prove your airworthiness. Right now, the FAA is giving out exemptions for more serious drone operators. They just handed out another 1,500 or so this week. This is stuff for the film industry, like you mentioned, real estate.
Right.
John Ruprecht, who we heard from earlier, he thinks the FAA's rules will be finalized. That's when Amazon and everyone else is going to get into this game.
So spitball it for me. When do you think I will be able to get whatever it is that I'm going to order from Amazon via drone to my front porch? So, no, seriously, right? Because that's where we're going.
It is where we're going. The FAA doesn't want like a drone swarm of biblical proportions. So the FAA.
Nor do I.
So I'm guessing, Kai, 2 years.
Wow.
I'm putting 2 years on it.
I'd have totally said like 5 to 8, but you're the tech guy. So whatever. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Kai.
Early rumors are that the head of Porsche, Matthias Müller, is his name, or Müller, perhaps. Anyway, he's set to be named CEO of Volkswagen maybe as early as tomorrow. We, though, are going to take our coverage a little bit closer to home. What do you do if you're a Volkswagen dealer here, and this big emissions mess just kind of lands in your lap? Oregon Public Broadcasting's John Sepulvedo reports from Portland they are going to be cleaning it up one customer at a time.
The way a dealership is designed to work is like this. A potential car buyer walks into the local showroom. And this potential buyer is like, ooh, look at this new Volkswagen Golf. That's cool. I'd like one of those. The salesperson comes over and talks about all the great amenities. Then haggle, haggle, haggle. And then cha-ching, sales made. But that's not the way it's working right now when it comes to diesel engine Volkswagens. Those cars are being pushed to the sides of showrooms, like this one outside of Portland, where the diesels sit apart, the sticker price is taken off the cars. Volkswagen has told dealers, don't sell them. And that's all many dealers have heard from the company.
Right now, we're waiting for guidance from Volkswagen of America on how to address the concerns. We're excited to help everybody once we know. And as soon as we do know, we'll be ready and willing to take care of everybody.
Michael Patrick is the service and parts director at Herzog Meyer Auto Center, a Volkswagen dealership outside of Portland. Patrick says he's gotten a lot of calls.
I don't know how many, but it's quite a bit, I can tell you that.
And he tells people, I'm sorry, but all I know about the recall and investigation is what you know. That's because much of what Patrick is learning is through media reports.
That's true. We know as much as you do.
Well, it's not uncommon in a crisis situation that the dealers are among the last to get communicated with.
That's Jack Nerad, an analyst with Kelley Blue Book.
And, you know, it is critical. Of course, the dealers are of critical importance to the success of any car company.
Nerad says car dealerships might be the last to hear about big problems from manufacturers, but they're often the first to handle them.
Basically, they are the interface between a major global car company and an individual in a local market. They're kind of the local face of that brand, and they do a very, very good job generally.
Those dealers are part of the reason why this past July, Volkswagen reported its sales were up 5% from the previous year. Still, sales of the German cars lag way behind other imports. Volkswagen sold just 30,000 cars in July. In that same month, Toyota sold more than 215,000 cars, while Honda sold over 140,000. And that brings us to this question. Is this scandal going to cost dealers more ground to their competitors? Not necessarily, says Ken Elias. He's a partner at the auto consulting firm, Marianne Keller and Associates.
You know, the bigger question, of course, is what does it mean for sales in the next couple months? I mean, are consumers overall just going to avoid VW products? That's the bigger question.
That's a question of loyalty. And among the most loyal customers Volkswagen has are U.S. diesel owners. Both Elias and Nerad of Kelley Blue Book say those loyal customers are the ones who are most likely to have the best relationship with their dealers. It's one of the big reasons Nerad says dealers, most likely, will be the ones cleaning up Volkswagen's mess. In Portland, I'm John Sepulvedo for Marketplace.
The British newspaper The Guardian had a VW story yesterday that caught our eye. The paper did some analysis of what a 500,000 Volkswagens and Audis here emitting way more pollutants than allowed would mean. And then
It did the same thing for 11 million cars worldwide. It's not hard math. Emissions per vehicle times number of vehicles times average miles driven. The worst case number you get for the cars in the U.S. is 40,000 extra tons of nitrous oxide, NOx as it's called, N-O-X. But is that a lot? What are the trickle-down costs? So many questions, both here and overseas. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more on that story.
Diesel cars aren't all that popular in America, so VW emissions won't have a huge impact. But it's not nothing, says Carl Matheson, one of the Guardian reporters who did the analysis.
Western Europe's largest coal power station is pretty much equivalent to how much these cars would have emitted on the roads each year.
Gauging the economic impact of a power plant's worth of pollution is challenging, but it can be done. It's the kind of thing University of Chicago economist Michael Greenstone does in his research.
Increased NOx emissions out of the car lead to higher ambient concentrations of ozone and possibly higher ambient concentrations of particulates. And then those two forms of air pollution in turn lead to health problems.
Those can include difficulty breathing, coughing, and aggravated asthma, emphysema, and chronic bronchitis. You can put a dollar amount on the impact.
I'd really have to do some back of the envelope calculations.
So we talked again later this afternoon after we had the chance to plug in some numbers.
The bottom line from my back of the envelope calculations, which should be interpreted with caution as they were done in 1 hour of work, is health costs of about $80 million per year in the United States.
He stresses these are not statistically significant results. And remember, diesel passenger cars are much more popular around the world, such as in Europe, where diesels make up more than half the cars on the road. Patrick Kinney is an environmental health sciences professor at Columbia.
It's an important impact on a global basis, and just magnify it if this extends beyond VW.
And it might. A study last year from the International Council on Clean Transportation found diesel cars, not just VWs, giving off an average of 7 times European standards. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we're in Russia, we're in Brazil. Ultimately, everybody likes pizza.
Maybe not everybody in the pizza thing, but I'll tell you what, everybody does like a profit. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 78 points today, not quite a half percent, 16,201. The NASDAQ off 18 points, more than a third percent, 4,734. The S&P 500 gave back 6 points, a third percent, 1932. Caterpillar is part of the Dow, helped drag it down. The heavy machinery maker said it may cut up to 10,000 jobs over the next 3 or so years. Shares off more than 6%. Falling oil prices mean falling share prices for oil and gas companies. Sand Ridge Energy off 2.8%. Bonanza Creek Energy down 2.4% today. Shares in BMW were off more than 5%. Wait for it, after a report that some of its cars were exceeding emissions expectations. Say it ain't so. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. My guess is that there isn't a leadership book out there you could find that would tell you that the best marketing tactic for your business that already happens to be in trouble is to tell everybody that your product is bad. Really bad. 5 years ago, though, Domino's did just that.
The sauce tastes like ketchup.
Pizza crust to me is like cardboard.
Worst excuse for pizza I've ever had.
Domino's launched an ad campaign in late 2009 saying they were scrapping it all and starting over, a whole new pizza. But it wasn't just zestier sauce and better cheese, it was also a new CEO, too. Patrick Doyle took over smack in the middle of the reboot, and now the company is selling 1 million pies a day at 12,000 restaurants worldwide. When we were out in Detroit last week, we took a detour over to Ann Arbor, Michigan, for this installment of Conversations from the Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
We start with this item from the little-known facts file. Domino's today is as much a tech company as it is a pizza place.
Wow, this is big.
It is big. So we've got.
I would not have expected a pizza company to have this big a tech operation.
So we employ about 700 people here in Ann Arbor, and about 300 of them are in technology. We believe by transaction counts that we are in the top five of e-commerce companies in the world. We know we're behind Apple and Amazon, but we may be as high as third. We're doing you know, between 9 and 10 billion in retail sales around the world this year.
Yep.
And, you know, about half of it is coming in digitally. So this
That's amazing.
The group that makes it work. So the magic all happens in here. So every new product gets tested here.
Wow.
All the new ideas that come through, all those sorts of things happen happen here in the test kitchen.
Not so long ago, you guys kind of realized that you had some problems.
We did.
Tell me about the big ad campaign that the media dubbed our pizza is really not very good.
Right.
But they used a tougher word.
They may have been even more blunt than that on it. Yeah. I still remember getting everybody into the room and saying, you know, folks, we got to make a change. We've got to do something different. Let's start from scratch. And it all happened in this room right here.
You knew you had a problem.
We didn't. We knew we had a problem. We had, you know, this was the company that had built the brand, the whole business around kind of fast delivery and reliable delivery. And Marketing 101 says you focus on your point of differentiation. So we kept talking about delivery. And
30 minutes or less.
30 right? minutes I mean, or less back in the day, exactly. And it just stopped working. We realized that everybody in the world who wanted fast, convenient pizza was already buying from us.
Yeah.
And the people who wanted a great pie simply were not.
How do you do that, though? How do you come to the point where you go out with an ad campaign where you, as a guy running a business that's largely franchisees, right?
Right.
You go out and you say, you know what? Our product sucks and we're going to fix it. Okay, there I said the word. You know?
Yeah, in fact, the biggest act of courage really was our franchisees saying, yeah, we're in. And we did that in the middle of the recession.
Right.
And we increased food costs.
Right. Yeah. And the bet was increased food costs are going to be recouped by
higher volume.
Sales.
By higher volume. Sales. That's exactly right.
Paid off?
Happily, it did.
Like a lot.
Like a lot, yeah. I mean, our sales, that first quarter we relaunched, were up 14.3%. We were up 9.9% for the year. And I will tell you, if I had known we were 9.9% and not 10.0 on December 31st, I would have bought some pizzas myself.
Remind me, what's the number of restaurants in the States?
Like, so a little over 5,000 in the U.S. Yeah.
Growth is slowing inside this country, right?
Right.
Where are you going to go?
So 95% of the population of the world lives outside of
here.
The U.S.
Yeah.
So we've got, you know, about 7,000 outside of the U.S. There is lots of room to grow. But there's still room in the U.S. We think we can get another 1,000 stores. And as big as we are, we're only selling maybe 1 in 8 pizzas in the U.S. There's a lot of room for us to grow in the U.S.
You say that like that's nothing. 1 in 8 pizzas. I mean, that's a staggering number.
Right.
Where do you like? India, China, South America? What do you like?
So
Seriously.
We are quickly approaching 1,000 restaurants in India. That is now, by store count, our biggest market outside of the U.S. There are over 1 billion people in India, so a lot of room to grow in India. The U.K. is a big market for us. China, we're still relatively small, but it's starting to move. We're in Russia. We're in Brazil. Ultimately, everybody likes pizza. So, you know, we think there's a big opportunity in an awful lot of places.
How do you guys figure out what's going to sell in Bombay or you know, in Shanghai, right? I mean, because here in Ann Arbor, what do we know?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. Here in Ann Arbor, what do we know? The answer is those decisions are made locally.
Really?
So we control quality here. We've got to approve the suppliers that they're going to use. But in terms of the taste, the new pizza topping that's going to come out in Mumbai, they come up with the new product launches there. We make sure that the quality is right. But they're the ones who are coming up with the ideas because they've got their finger on the pulse of the consumer in Mumbai.
Biggest headwind for you right now? What's your biggest problem?
Oh, boy, you know, we're doing awfully well right now. We've had a lot of sales growth. I worry, as 50% of our sales now are digital.
Yeah.
I worry about cybersecurity. Any CEO who is not paranoid about that right now is just not spending enough time worrying about it. But you can't control everything.
Is there such a thing as too big in your mind? Is that possible?
Boy, you know, too big for us right now is not within range of anything
really?
I have to worry about.
Because you look at Starbucks, right? I mean, I had a conversation with Howard Schultz.
Right.
And he was like, we're going to grow and we're going to open a gazillion restaurants. 18 months later, they're pulling back and they're closing places.
Right.
that you're, that's not in your worry set?
No, and, you know, Howard has more restaurants today in the U.S. than he did before that pullback.
Well, there is a Starbucks everywhere. That's true.
And so, no, I really don't. And we've got, you know, defined delivery areas for our stores. We really know pretty much exactly how many stores we can still build. And, again, you go back to the international side, there is growth opportunity for us there for a very long time.
Patrick Doyle, thanks very much for your time.
Kai, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
That was a working test kitchen, by the way. Sorry about all that fan noise. We took a whole bunch of pictures of Domino's HQ while we were out there. Videos as well. They're on our website. Also, you can hear the whole interview with Patrick Doyle on our Corner Office podcast. It's got tasting rooms, something called the Sensory Lab. It's all at marketplace.org or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. This final note on the way out today, in which emojis, I don't know, maybe they have finally gone a step too far. I'll tell you about it. You guys decide. In honor of the Pope's visit, Twitter has rolled out a whole new set of them. Depending on the hashtag you use, Pope in US, Pope in DC, Pope in NYC, or Pope in Philly, you get a little image of Francis in front of the flag or the US Capitol, the Statue of Liberty, or the Liberty Bell. I don't know. Oh, look at the time. We got to go. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will be back tomorrow. I had extra time. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.